There's been a surge in heroin use in the United States in recent years, and it may come as a surprise to learn that a large amount of the drug is being shipped through New York City. At the same time, harm reduction programs like needle exchanges and a wider availability of an anti-overdose drug are gaining political traction. Joining us now are New York Times reporter J. David Goodman, who recently wrote about why the drug is turning up throughout the five boroughs, and by BuzzFeed contributor John Neffel, who wrote an article called Do Less Harm. We have links to both on our show page, and I'm very pleased to welcome David and John to our show.
Oh, hello. Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
David, the amount of heroin that's been seized by law enforcement in New York City this year is already higher than any year going back to 1991. How much heroin are we talking about?
Well, we're talking – this is now – it's very hard to get statistics on all of the heroin that's passing through New York City. But when you look at some of the top-level traffickers, which the special narcotics prosecutor does, they have seized already 288 pounds of heroin, which is already more than they seized all of last year. And when they look back at their seizures to 91, they have not a single year that it's over that.
And do they have any theories as to why we are seeing this resurgence?
Well, there's a lot of ideas about where this has come from. I mean – New York has always been a hub for the drug trade, going back to the last time heroin was a problem in the city and the country.
But it was replaced by other drugs until fairly recently.
That's right. And what they're seeing is a move away from cocaine coming into the country from Mexico and towards heroin. And one of the drivers of that, most law enforcement people will say, is, the sort of proliferation of opioid pills, these prescription pain pills that have, been abused to such a heavy degree in this country. And those become expensive when, you start to become addicted to them. And so you find that a lot of users, not all, but a significant portion will switch to using heroin, which gives the same high.
So when they can't get their prescription for the painkiller, they wind up finding heroin on the street.
That happens in a lot of cases. You also have younger new users who are maybe not getting a prescription at all, but are using the drugs as a sort of as a recreational method, and they crush the pills, they snort them. And the other reason you have this switch to heroin is that the heroin that's coming in is a lot more pure than it was in the 70s. You have heroin that is you can sniff, which was not the case as far as I've been told in the 1970s. So it's a slower transition. You sniff the pills, you sniff the heroin, then you start to shoot it.
John, doesn't that make it more dangerous? Because the purer the heroin, the more likely you are to overdose?
Yeah, it does. And that's one thing that also is a major concern about fentanyl-laced heroin, which, of course, was the type of heroin that Philip Seymour Hoffman was at least initially thought to have used when he overdosed. And one of the problems with fentanyl-laced heroin is that sometimes this anti-overdose drug, naloxone, isn't enough to bring somebody back if they've been using this incredibly powerful heroin.
Now, naloxone is an antidote that was developed in the 60s, and so it's been around a while. It was developed by Sankyo. Why are we only hearing about it now in this country? Hasn't it been in use around the world?
Well, I think part of the reason that we're hearing about it now is, as David was saying, that the numbers for opioid overdoses have gone so high. And so naloxone has been used in hospitals for decades, but it's only in the past couple years that it's sort of seen wider use among pilot programs for cops, for EMTs, and then in some states there's a standing order where these organizations that pass out naloxone to drug users and their families actually don't have to have a doctor on site to do the prescribing. It's sort of like a flu shot, and that's only the case in 7 states, but it lowers a lot of the barriers to getting naloxone to people who are most likely to be there when somebody overdoses.
But it also is criticized for making kind of allowing for more drug use, and as are needle exchange programs.
Sure. That's one of the common things that you hear from people who say that needle exchanges are a form of condoning drug use, or that naloxone will sort of give somebody a pass to use more because they know that they can be brought back. And the data really doesn't hold that up. Needle exchanges don't actually increase risky behavior. And when you talk to people who have been naloxone, that is, who have been had overdoses reversed. It's an incredibly painful process. It sends you into immediate withdrawal. And so this idea that it's a sort of get out of jail free card, I think really doesn't hold up when you actually talk to people who have had the experience.
David, roughly 35% of the heroin seized by the DEA since October has been confiscated in New York State alone. Is most of the heroin being used in New York, or is the city serving as a kind of a distribution hub?
It is a distribution hub. A lot of it is being used here. Again, it's sort of, you know, the classic story of the broader economy. You know, we have a major market here, and then we're a hub to bring the good, as it were, to many other places. And so you have traffickers who will bring it to New York to sort of distribution centers almost, and they site these at places, you know, up in the North Bronx around thoroughfares, the Major Deegan or the I-95, to get it north to Vermont, to Massachusetts, and also south to Washington, D.C., to Baltimore.
And who's bringing it in?
This is they're primarily Mexican cartels, at least as far as—
The cartels that we've associated with first marijuana and then cocaine?
That's right. And what the DEA and other law enforcement officials are seeing is that these same sort of trafficking routes, the sort of same methods that were used to bring cocaine in, are now being used to bring heroin in. And they're seeing a steady decline in the amount of cocaine and a steady increase in the amount of heroin.
Well, is that because it's being pushed, the heroin, or and there are other ways that cocaine is being prevented from coming into the country? Or are we just going through another cycle where heroin, which used to be popular in, the 50s and 60s, is suddenly popular again?
Well, I think, you know, when you talk to people that work in the treatment community who have been around or maybe were addicts themselves in the 1970s, you know, what they talk about is how, you know, younger users don't really understand the risks involved because they didn't live through that. So you have a really interesting sort of trend lines where, you know, you have a lot of younger users in certain demographic groups that maybe weren't touched by the last heroin epidemic who are now using. And in those older groups, they've sort of trickled off and stopped.
Well, doesn't most heroin come from Asia? How did the Mexicans wind up getting a drug that we're hearing an awful lot about from Afghanistan and other countries in Asia?
Yeah, the production in Afghanistan is at all-time highs. I think, what is it, it's either 80 or 90% of the opium throughout the world comes from Afghanistan, but most of the heroin that's found in the United States does come either from Mexico or from South America.
So it's produced, it's made into heroin in Mexico rather than in New York?
That's my understanding of it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there is a sort of common misunderstanding about the way the heroin sort of trail, so to speak, works now. I mean, in the 70s, you did have heroin coming over from Turkey and from Afghanistan, you know, very complicated routes that entered through South America and up into this country. But in terms of the testing that the DEA has done on heroin that's around now, they believe that almost all of it is produced either in Colombia or in Mexico and is then sold here. It's refined there, so to speak. It's sort of made into powder form down there and then brought in. So when you have, you know, heroin mills, quote unquote, here in New York City, that's actually a place where they will just sort of, you know, cut the heroin, the pure heroin, and bag it. But they're not actually making it here. They make it down there.
And they're making it into brands, aren't they?
Yeah, stamping it with brands the same as you see on with marijuana, with cocaine. It's a sort of tool of the trade, as it were. And I think one of the things that's important to remember when we talk about heroin use is, and why it's sort of we're seeing this resurgence, is that the CDC says that 12 million people in 2010 abused prescription painkillers. So we're talking about a huge, huge number of Americans who have abused prescription painkillers that far outpaces heroin use. But the much touted story that pill users move to heroin, especially younger users, that does turn out to be true. So we've really set the stage in the United States for not only use to increase in the last couple years, but likely to continue to increase in the near future.
Are hospitals seeing more and more people with overdoses?
I'm not sure about the numbers sort of nationwide, but certainly when you talk to people, you know, I was talking to somebody in North Carolina for my story, and she said that it's absolutely at epidemic rates, and that when you go to rehab facilities, it used to be everyone was on cocaine, and then now everyone's on heroin. Mm-hmm.
David, do we know why the highest rate of overdoses in the city has been in Staten Island?
Well, there's a number of reasons for that. I mean, it sort of mimics the national trends. So you've had heroin you sort of steep increases in the use of heroin in places like Vermont, where maybe they didn't have the drug at all, you know, previously. It's demographic in some cases. It's, you know, it's
is it replacing meth?
Not in Staten Island per se. I
mean, no, but in more rural areas.
That I'm not certain. Well, you know, actually, to a large extent, the heroin surge has been in the Northeast, which didn't have a massive number of. There's meth here, but it's not to the degree that you have in other parts of the country. But you know, in Staten Island, what you had was a lot of sort of what we were saying before, a lot of pill abuse, and almost to the person that I interviewed out there who was getting over their heroin addiction. They had started by, pills, opioid pills. And what it's sort of you hear from these younger users is it was like a sort of free-for-all. You know, they go to school and people were trading the pills that either they found in their, the medicine cabinet of their parents, or there were doctors that were sort of indiscriminately writing prescriptions for people that would come in claiming some sort of, you know, back pain. And, you know, there is an issue with chronic pain in the country that needs to be addressed, but there's also many experts would say is an overprescribing of opioid pills to address things like headaches, migraines.
Differences in prices in different parts of the country? Is it cheaper here because there is more available than in Maine or Vermont?
Yeah, I mean, that's what, everyone who's looked at this says, the same sort of economy of scale that you have in New York City, and also the fact that you're getting it closer to the source, it's much cheaper here. You know, they've found it as cheap as $40,000 per kilogram, whereas it might be double that in a place like, Boston or Springfield, Mass.
John, do the public health advocates you spoke with frame the severity of the problem the same way?
Most of them do, yeah. They say that the heroin epidemic is real, that the numbers are surging, and that the best way to deal with it is through this approach that many of the people I talked with work in a practice called harm reduction, which is distributing naloxone, distributing needles, and talking to people where they're at and attempting to get them either to use in a maintenance kind of a way and then trickle down to not using at all.
So are all police officers being given naloxone to carry around with them in case they come upon somebody who's suffering from an overdose?
The program is the widest in Staten Island. I'm not sure if it encompasses every single officer. Do you know, David?
Yeah, but the idea is to get it to the patrol officers, so the ones that are actually doing their rounds. And so far it's been extended to all the precincts in Staten Island. It started with one in the north, and then it encompasses all of them now.
And have you spoken to police officers? Do they think this is a good idea?
I think they do. I mean, you know, it's interesting. So far, at last check, there were three overdoses that were reversed by police officers. It was as of the first 4 months of the year. And during that time, the fire department, which has their ambulances that they run, had reversed about a little more than 40. So you actually see a lot more interaction, of course, in sort of the medical community. And you've always had paramedics that carried this. But what they've done as well, the fire department has done, is to give naloxone to not only the paramedics, which are sort of the life, when people are at risk of losing their life, you go with the paramedics, but with the basic EMTs. You have now all ambulances that are run by the fire department have naloxone, and also engine companies. So these are firefighters who are trained EMTs, and they'll carry it as well. So you have this sort of blanketing of the city with this drug that's been really called for. I mean, there is some resistance to it, but in general, I think the feeling is that this isn't so much a moral hazard as a sort of moral necessity now, that you need parents of children who have in their 20s who have succumbed to an overdose are really clamoring to be able to get the drug themselves more easily, because they're the ones who are often finding their children at home unconscious.
My guests are J. David Goodman of the New York Times and John Neffel of BuzzFeed. We're talking about a resurgence of heroin use, especially based in New York City, and we'll take a little break, and when we come back, we will look into the matter even further. And we are back with John Neffel, who wrote an article for BuzzFeed, where he's a contributor, called Do Less Harm, and J. David Goodman, who has reported on the resurgence of heroin for the New York Times. The New York State legislature in Albany has passed a Good Samaritan law recently, which protects users who call 911 if they witness an overdose. Do you think that, do other states have similar laws?
Yeah, there have been incredible number of Good Samaritan laws that have been passed in recent years, and many of them have been since around 2007, 2008, and since then. And they're very, very helpful for people who, you know, who do witness overdoses. I think the problem for some people is that they don't necessarily trust that they will actually be enforced, that the law will be enforced. So they worry that even if there's a law on the books, that doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be safe if
but
they
in,
call
in the
it.
Past, they were vulnerable to arrest because they were in a situation where drugs were being used.
Yeah, and that was a big issue in a small town in Wisconsin, actually, where a lawmaker's daughter overdosed, and the people that she was with left her, and so that lawmaker then introduced a Good Samaritan law in Wisconsin as it sort of touched his family.
David, I was surprised to learn that in New York and New Jersey, the naloxone pilot program is funded through asset forfeiture. Why is that considered a rather controversial approach?
Well, I think, you know, there's some question as to – these are assets connected to drug cases that are not always completed. They can be taken, you know, as, you know, arrests are made or even – I believe even before. So there is some controversy in terms of how are law enforcement sort of officials taking people's property, you know, in the early stages of a case. I think it's very appealing, though, from a political standpoint because – and this is how it was presented when Attorney General Eric Schneiderman presented it in New York, that, you know, we're using sort of essentially drug money or the ill-gotten proceeds from the drug trade to then save people from that same thing. So it has a real appeal, even if there is a sort of undercurrent of controversy there.
Has it gone up to higher courts?
That I'm not certain of.
I'm not
you don't
sure.
Know. I imagine this is going to be something that will eventually wind up in the Supreme Court. Confiscated money then being used. Well, first of all, there's the whole matter of forfeited ill-gotten gains anyway, isn't there? I mean, that has been a controversial issue for a while.
I do think, though, you know, even if that – if there were some, heat on that issue, I think there's so much now support in the sort of political in New York, at least in the political world, that they would find another way to get that money. I don't think that would put this program at risk in any way.
Well, John, you've written it's not a moment too soon that harm reduction is finally getting political traction.
Yeah, it's something that is really in some ways still mired in the kind of culture wars of the 90s. For instance, there's still a federal ban on using federal money to fund needle exchanges, and that's that was put in place in the late 80s, and it was lifted briefly by President Obama in 2009. It was then reintroduced by Republicans, and so you have in many ways states responding to this crisis in a way that the federal government hasn't really shown itself willing to do.
Critics of safe injection sites say that they lead to an uptick in crime and, as we said earlier, pretty much sanctioned drug use. Do they have a point? Do we see more crime?
Well, so I spoke with people who run a facility called Insight, which is in Vancouver, Columbia, and it's the only – it's called a safer or supervised injection facility. It's the only one of its kind in North America. And in the lead-up to that facility opening in 2003, local businesses were afraid of that very thing. And what's happened, what's been sort of amazing to watch is since it's existed, there have been over 30 peer-reviewed studies that show that none of the fears have come to pass, that crime has either stayed level or gone down, and that it hasn't attracted new users.
Should we be surprised that the only program that of this sort is in Vancouver, in Canada, not the United States?
I don't think that should be surprising at all. And I think some people in the United States are sort of hopeful that at some point that could happen here. I think that that's a long way off, as evidenced by the fact that there are still about half the states in the country where needle exchanges are sort of de facto criminalized.
And I imagine that the political situation in this country would kind of make it a little difficult to get these through most state legislatures.
Sure. I mean, I think there's a general sort of squeamishness, you know, not just in the political world, but amongst most, you know, Americans, to the idea of what's known as heroin maintenance, the idea that you would sort of sanction a place where people can use the drug. Although this does, it's not just in Canada, it's in Europe. It's there are countries that have these sorts of facilities and do sort of, at least it's my understanding that these allow people that are sort of addicted to heroin to maintain normal lives and not sort of get engaged in criminal behavior to sort of get their drug or sustain it.
And well, John, you write about underground needle exchanges. So are they operating illegally?
Yeah, there are. It's the same as with any prohibition, whether it's drugs or whether it's people who serve drug users. There was a woman in my story who I called Linda, who operates an illegal needle exchange in a city in North Carolina. And she moves around a lot, and she carries boxes of needles with her and cookers and ties and all of the paraphernalia that she can offer to people to use as safely as possible. And as a result, she has been arrested for heroin possession of needles with heroin residue in Sharps containers that people have turned back into her. And of course, if they hadn't turned those back into her, they could have been left in a park. They could have been flushed down a toilet. And so people who do this underground work really do face tremendous personal threats.
You visited a bathroom in Washington Heights, which you call perhaps the most politically significant bathroom in the country.
Yeah, so this bathroom in the Washington Heights Corner Project is really, really interesting. And as I say in the story, I think it's pushing the borders of what people are doing to keep heroin users alive. So the rules of the bathroom are you can't use heroin there, but if you do use heroin, they won't let you die. So it's a needle exchange. The office is a needle exchange, and people can sign up to get in line for the bathroom, and they have 10 minutes to do what they will. Drug use is not sanctioned, but there are methods that have been put in place over the years where they're responding to the fact that if you're serving drug users, you're going to have people using drugs.
In the past, people put blue lights in bathrooms so that the drug users couldn't find their veins.
Yeah, so some programs have sort of responded to people using drugs in their bathroom by saying, we're going to close the bathroom. If you come and get a needle or a box of needles that day, you can't use our bathroom. And what the Corner Project has done is said, let's not ignore this. Let's actually face it head on and try to keep people from using in a Burger King bathroom down the street. Let's have them be in a place where if they do overdose, we can try to bring them back. And they've done that about 50 times.
It could just as easily be a McDonald's or a Wendy's, right?
Exactly.
David, a special narcotics prosecutor told you that her office was working against large-scale operations that are growing in sophistication and output. Do we know how many major players there are in the heroin trade in New York?
Well, this is something that we're working to understand, as are the officials. I mean, I think it's very hard, as I pose this question to lots of different levels of the government, from federal authorities to state and local authorities. The response is sort of the same. This is not a openly traded. These are not public companies, so it's very hard to get a handle on precisely how many there are, but they have said, not just that they're seeing, they're seizing more heroin, but they're seizing it from more mills. There are more of these places that, and each of them are, they're churning out, hundreds of thousands of glassine bags for users. So this is, it's not just that, you have a couple people getting involved in this, but you have multiple areas.
Now, has there been a link up with the people who are concerned about HIV/AIDS? Because heroin use is one of the ways that, or dirty needles are one of the ways that HIV has been transmitted.
Yeah, that's really one of the central tenets of harm reduction, is that using clean needles is a way to minimize your risk for getting HIV. Also, Hep C is an incredible something that people in harm reduction are very, very worried about right now, because it's more robust and it can actually stay alive longer in cookers. So it's not only sharing needles, but it's sharing other forms of paraphernalia.
Do either of you get the sense that there'll come a time when we will have a more European-style method of dealing with heroin abuse?
Well, from the perspective of the people that I've been interviewing, I don't think that's a desired outcome, but I would leave it to John to see if that's
possible. Well, we're seeing pot decriminalization in some parts of the country.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're a long, long way away from prescribing heroin as a maintenance or anything like that, or even a safer injection facility. But I think that methods of reversing overdoses that law enforcement are in favor of are the kind of methods that we'll see those being taken up throughout the country.
Has there been a cutback in methadone treatment?
That I don't know the answer to that question, actually.
I'm not sure if there's been a cutback. Most of the people that I have spoken with who have stopped using heroin did use methadone, and they sort of say that it's deeply unpleasant but better than sticking yourself with a needle.
We're out of time, unfortunately. I thank you both so much for being with us. John Neffel of BuzzFeed, his article, Do Less Harm, a number of articles from J. David Goodman in the New York Times. It is kind of shocking that we're seeing this resurgence of heroin, a terrible drug.
Certainly. It doesn't seem like something that's going to go away anytime soon.